Right, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. My name is Ricky Burdett from the LSE Cities Programme, and I'm delighted to welcome you here tonight on behalf of the LSE, the LSE Cities Programme, and the Royal Academy. And bless you. As some of you will know, this is the second in the series of three lectures being co-organized, co-sponsored by the Royal Academy and the RA, with David Adjaye giving the last of the three on the 2nd of December, in a month's time from now. And I think maybe some of you will have heard the introduction to Kiss Christiansim last month, that the themes that we are addressing both in the city's program and in the series are very much at the center of a debate which is very live in London, and that is very simply linking what to do with the physical fabric of a city like London, which is about to expand dramatically in terms of its growth, and how to deal with the social and economic and the cultural impact of that on the ground. And I think it's probably fair to say that this issue of linking the physical and the social probably has been thought about, considered, played with, and dealt with more effectively by Ralph Erskine for over 70 years, perhaps, than any other architect born in the 20th century. And Johannes Tovat, who is his partner in the firm Erskine Tovat, is very, very welcome as a guest here tonight to talk about some of these issues. It's worth spending just a few minutes to remind ourselves of Ralph's background. He set up in practice became established in Sweden after having been, of course, born in this country at the outset of the Second World War, and a quarter of a century after that, Johannes was born. So just we have to put things into perspective. And when Johannes met him, and he may be reflecting on this at the age of 16, when he bought a boat from Ralph, he was extremely established as one of the major architects in Sweden, not just with housing projects, but also with major sort of state-funded projects, hospitals, and other social projects. Why it's so interesting, I think, to us to reflect with Johannes, that's why we've invited him here, is in a way to understand not just the product, the architecture, and what the design does to the people who live in the communities which are created by them, but very importantly, the process. And I think that's something that certainly the architectural profession for generations probably has dealt little with the issue of process. But more recently, there is a whole new activity called community architecture, which deals so much with the process that I would say perhaps sometimes they or we forget about the product. And I think Johannes brings to us today, with some projects that he will be describing, this interaction of how decisions are made about making architecture, very much the heart of the debate, so that we can understand, I hope, from him what it is about this Scandinavian way, what it is about some of the projects even we saw last time with Kees Christiansen, which can deliver not just housing projects, which is what we're beginning to see built up and down this country, housing projects, things which feel like housing estates, but how it is that they've been able to create genuine sort of communities which feel not that as if they've always been there, but as if you would want to live there. I will never forget, after Ralph and Johannes won the competition for the Greenwich Millennium Village, which you will be talking about, in 1997, going to visit and meeting the great man, and he took us around the Ekerö housing estate, built in the 80s, not far from their wonderful office. And just, you know, it was like, I was brought up in Italy, it was like walking around Siena. It really was. And this was something which had only been there for 20 years. And it's not to do with the quality of the materials or the richness of the texture and the color, but very much to do with the spatial articulation and the way that people connected to that. I think, therefore, the issues we're interested in, Johannes, and hearing from you, and I hope that, I know that you will be addressing some in your talk, and if not, we might pick some up in the questions and the discussion afterwards. The issues which I think are of great interest to us are issues of density. I know Richard McCormack is here, who's obsessed by the issue of density at the moment in urban and suburban development. How do you get it right? How do you create dense urban environments and mix not just the uses so that it feels urban and urbane, but also mix the residents and the people who are using, working and living in these environments. And I think the one phrase which cuts across the work that Johannes and his colleagues have done for years is there's a sort of effortlessness. It sort of seems as if it's easy, and of course it isn't. And I think he may share why that is. It is very interesting that this firm, which is now building not just across Sweden, but other countries in Europe, including the Czech Republic and Ireland, has remained 10 people large. It's never really grown greater than that, and it's remained the same. So I'm delighted that Johannes is here to talk about these issues. So will you join me in welcoming Johannes? Thank you very much.
Just thinking maybe you should continue. It's always nice to listen to you, Ricky. yes, it was a bit of a pretentious introduction maybe, but very nice, I suppose, or it was. I heard that actresses or actors that gets the Oscar award, they live 10 years younger, 10 years longer. So maybe that's the case for me as well. After this, or after your introduction, at least, I'll try to talk about these things if possible. You got to bear my excuse my English. I'm not born into it, and it's this project, this Greenwich project, has taught me quite a lot. But I won't have your speed in talking, which is maybe nice. I'll speak the Swedish way. Just a few. I have a bit of a sort of pre-introduction here of talking about the office a bit. Briefly, and then I'll speak about trying to summarize what I believe is the sort of urban planning philosophy of the office. And I will talk about examples and constraints that we as architects and urban planners and clients and you name it are involved in the production of urban fabrics. I will also I will talk about the Swedish way. Previously, Sweden, I think the Swedes felt that they had a third way. The American was one, the Soviet Union was one, and Sweden was the middle way. It was very pretentious. Swedes are not so pretentious, but in that matter they were, I think. And then I will... I'll speak about the Swedish way of planning, which is quite interesting, I think, in comparing the English problems or opportunities and possibilities you have and what we have done instead. Talk a little bit about Greenwich, the Greenwich Millennium Village project, and a few other things. Yes, I met Ralph Erskine when I was very young. I lived on the same island, actually, into the big lake, Mälaren, which is west of Stockholm. Sorry, I'm a bit dry, I don't know why. And I passed his office and his ship, same thing, every day to school. And so from, 7 years old, and I liked it, and I wanted to become a captain myself. Always. And I saw the... It was not kept in good shape. He left this sailing... the Thames barge. It's a sailing Thames barge built in Greenwich, actually, in the beginning of last century. And it was left as an office in the beginning of the 70s. And they... he was a very clever man when he arrived, of course, to Sweden, to the land of farmers, I think, you know, really a silent people of the north. In 1939, he was interested in the Swedish functionalist architecture, and many foreigners came to Sweden during that time. And the war came, and he stayed. He couldn't get back. He tried to go via Finland back during the war to participate, but couldn't. So he stayed. And in the mid 50s, he bought this ship from London for a symbolic sum, and made an office out of it. He had 11 drawing tables in it. And they each sort of late spring, early summer, they went out in the archipelago and moved the office from the boat into a shed, this red building here. All architects and their families stayed on different, in small huts on this island out in the archipelago, and they stayed for about 3 months every summer. And that was the most productive time of the year, without any internet, of course, at that time. And this is the interior of the ship. Actually, I managed once to try. I was a captain once, very shortly in the late 60s, very, very shortly though. But he was a generous man already then. I bought the ship in 1979 for 10. One Swedish crown, with the ambition to sail to West Indies. Unfortunately, it didn't work, and a few years later, she was destroyed. A sad process. Yes, I will try to summarize a bit of the philosophy, which is, I've just lectured once in the past, and to students, and this was an opportunity to really get down to the bones of what I've been doing since I was sort of 19, 20. Since I never completed any formal education, and sort of that was, I went to School of Architectures, various schools, but never completed. So he was my education in a way. And so it's a good time to summarize. And so, you know, what is urban planning about? I think it's clearly one of the most durable structures we have on Earth. I mean, we have been building cities for about 100 human life cycles, which is not long, of course. They are, it's a sort of a fundamental part of us as individuals, and they all form a very simple framework to our daily life, one could say. The rules are perhaps very few and simple. It's about recognition or definition of what is public and private in a way. It's it's a combination of the individual and the common. And it's a clear way of movement that this structure creates, clearly. It's also, of course, creating a physical framework for an organization and work, trade, all these typical things that urban living or urban structures is about. It's giving the framework for landscape and beauty. And then all of a sudden, something happened, not very long ago, of course. You know, you all know about it. I try not to speak as an architect here. All these zones appeared. The vast scale of everything. The specific function appeared. The non-landscape appeared. All these very strange elements. To this, these basic rules of urbanism or urban living or urban planning, and you know, in that sense, that the conflicts which we are so deeply involved in as human beings and and in our environment. These conflicts became evil. They were unnecessary things. And the whole sort of industrial revolution, I think, 100 or even 200 years after it occurred, smashed into our sort of daily lives in terms of how we live, how we interact, how we move. Very late, actually, compared to the actual industrial revolution. And one can say it's in my mind, be provocative here, it's the beginning of a non-culture, a non-urban culture. This is actually not, I'm talking against myself in compared to the picture here. This is Vällingby. It was famous in the 50s, just outside Stockholm when the underground was built, a satellite town or a community, and you can tell that it's carefully thought through in terms of movements. What is what? You know, everything is clear how it's organized, and it was the model for the future. This is now being restored into the glory of the 50s. Everything is restored in back, so it looks it's just the people that got to be reshaped slightly. The funny thing about this urban structure is that it's so much like a body in a way. It is very, very complex, and it's very vulnerable. It's and very, very dependent on its surroundings. It can't live without its surrounding. And I think the more complex an urban structure is, the more this vulnerable thing is of course more sensitive. And that's how, of course, during time, cities and towns and villages, they have flourished and they have collapsed always because of the destruction and the maybe the extreme environments they have created. They have consumed too much. They have lost the balance with their surroundings, and they died. We don't die anymore, of course. We have pipelines. We have all sorts of communications that take care of our survival. But we are, and that's actually one of the beauties, in a way, if I'll try to make myself clear, that we are in an age where we can't die with our cities because of mismanagement. We have to take care. We have to find ways through the horrors we are facing. And this is, of course, not London. This is not Stockholm or anything. It's the other world, which we are very little aware of, far away from us. And they have the same issue. They have the same problem. They got to survive, and they got to find the ways forward. And I'll return to that, of course. Yes. It's also interesting to see the extreme, or Richard Rogers talk about the single-minded urban structure. That the more single-minded, the more extreme it becomes in our modern society, the more destructive or detrimental it is to itself, socially, environmentally, aesthetically. That is, the more functionalistic, or the more functional, the more precise it becomes as a structure and environment, the more detrimental it is. And we can see it in the of course in old communities as well. It's one image from a biker before it was turned down in favor of something else. It's also clear that there are other components. It's not just the extreme of an environment that is detrimental. It's also, of course, the human rights things, which we, you know, it's not our problem really today, but the vast majority of the world has that specific problem, and that as well, of course, is one of the fundamental problems to healthy city environments. You know these images, you've seen them, and but you've probably not been there. It's just a memory of the other world. And these were Roger's words about the single-minded and the open-minded. The single-minded as the extreme, the open-minded as something different, and the example of the good example of an urban situation or a city. And I will come back to that. It's an image of Stockholm, and again, the clear expression of the thought or the tradition of the modern movement. Again, the single-minded, the road, the ring road, the parking, the shopping, these zones of the modern tradition that's crushed into our lives and communities. Same is, of course, for the housing estate. It is single-minded. It was very single-minded in the past, and it still is, of course. Not so much here, but in the rest of the world, even more. And it's, of course, very difficult to, as an individual or an architect or, you know, whoever, to interact in these single-minded communities. How do you participate? How do you bring something of yourself into it? How do you restore? And that is the single-minded environment's biggest problem, that the participation is very difficult. On the other hand, the open-minded is very different. We can't, of course, with the big scale of our societies, create open-minded societies or open-minded structures everywhere, but because it's some... We'll return to that. Clearly, it is easier when this participation is assisted by an open-minded structure or a city. We find it everywhere in the past, of course. Prague is a good example of very open-minded spaces between buildings. What does it bring? It brings, of course, it creates conflicts, or it supports conflicts between people and physical things. Clearly, it stimulates us to interact, or the opposite, to be lonely, or to withdraw and create sort of anonymous world around ourselves. Just a couple of images from Freiburg in Germany, how they brought these open water, what do you call it in English, channels, not really channels, but it's the drainage water from roofs, etc. They disappeared during the single-minded period of time, course, underneath, and were brought back again up to the surface, and of course immediately life starts, or conflicts start to, as you can see the car there, it's probably quite painful to park, but it works and it's probably very inspiring. Erskine did during, he's probably quite famous for this biker scheme. We saw one image previously of how it was in the past. And he was brought in not necessarily due to a specific type of architecture, but because of his personality, I think. The way he interacted, his political standpoint, his ideals, etc. And he talks about the civil society's participation very early on in his career, and he really established a method during the biker project in the 60s, during the whole of the 70s. And participation is, of course, not something which belongs to the glorious political past of the 60s or 70s. It is reality. Participation, not necessarily in a design process, but participation is about restoring the open-minded society or open-minded urban society, that without that it's not possible, clearly. And without our contribution, individual or in group or whatever, it's not possible to create better environments. Simple as that. You correct me if I'm wrong afterwards. It's interesting, I just had some new taken photographs from that scheme. I never liked it personally. I felt it was very brutal, parts of it, and very strange, very odd architecture. But it was part of its time, and it does contain, if you ever go there, it has some kind of long-lasting values in it. It creates, it looks into the details, it finds, it's creating a sort of juxtaposition of large and small, etc., etc. It is, you can find very, very specific urban qualities within that scheme, despite maybe its time and the way it has been weathered or deteriorated or whatever the English word is. You can see the nightmare of an architect, probably, or the joy for architects. You can see that they do take care, they participate. They restore and they add on, and they are inspired, probably. And as inspired people often do, they inspire other people. We have also, of course, the opposite. And when one is 90 plus, as Ralph is, one has to be prepared to see one's projects and darlings dying. It's looking at the wider picture, I felt it was so strange to walk. I normally just come to London by airplane. I go to the tube. I know exactly. I use the same toilet. And when I get to the airport, Heathrow Express tube, taxi, and that's it. And meetings, and back again. And I had the opportunity today to walk around. Really, it was a wonderful day, of course, as you all know. And I felt, why should I stand here and talk about these things? You know it, you've seen it, you experience it daily. And it's maybe not that. It's because that's the problem. We take these qualities of the open-minded society for granted, or open-minded urban society for granted, and we know what the qualities are, but we have a world that doesn't. And imagine the future problems we will face, all of us here in this room. We have half of the population of the world's population live in cities today. It will increase rapidly over the next 100 years. There's 250,000 more inhabitants on the planet each day, which is London every month. And they go to the cities. They will arrive to the cities, here and everywhere else, mainly everywhere else. And as if we were the last species or creature on Earth, we have in a way turned the back to this. We always do. We have to. We can't cope. And that's why I think we as architects or clients, I can see one client here, it's nice, I'll try to behave. We have, of course, an immense responsibility early on in planning processes. We do affect just a couple of figures, and if you didn't think we do. Like this, that's a large amount, one third of all energy and two thirds of all electricity used in the United States is building related. And in vast amounts of horrible stuff these materials produce, of course. And Sweden is one of the leading countries in the European Union to try to fight against the toxic stuff in building materials. They're sort of obsessed by it. It's quite interesting. And they're doing well. And the water we consume, of course. Or the water our things, like buildings, consume. This is interesting for you, straight on. You read quicker than I speak, so be silent. The These are issues we are dealing with quite a lot and have been dealing with very much in the Greenwich project, and we had clear target points early on that this is where we can make a difference for the future. And also how this will affect in the next 100 years or so, or 110, I mean, the next decade or so, that there is a vast amount of land going into being transformed from whatever use today to built environments. 350,000 football pitches is good for English souls. They understand what that means. And clearly, yes, we will, within 100 years, probably need another Earth if we carry on. You know all this, and it's good to remember. So what do the Swedes do? They play football, and they are very much like you. Of course, we are very much like, much the same, I suppose. We have a very different way of planning things, we have a different approach to urban planning, and I like to go through that. A list few images from what we do, because I've actually minimized our own projects to a large extent here. I don't know why it just turned out to be that way, actually, but just a few. It's a little tiny children's village up in the north, next to a big river in the wilderness. For young people creating creative things, we do things like that. A little village of its own. We are involved in sort of civic buildings like universities. This is the University Aula in Stockholm, a big sort of Greek theater, an auditorium, which we did a few years ago. Very Scandinavian, I suppose. A big auditorium. We just won a competition a year ago in Stockholm, bit outside the city center. Very nice, potentially very nice location. It's about 1,400 units and 30,000 square meter of commercial space. And this is moving on now into the next stage, and so I can't show you anything except for a competition entry, not because of security, because of it's a very boring planning process. And I'll talk about that instead, how we do things. We were involved in the early 90s in a master planning projects close to the very core of the Stockholm city center, Hammarby Sjöstad, our equivalent to Millennium Village, but slightly bigger. Or actually, I'll compare that later on. But it's a vast area. It was also a brownfield site up to the end of the 80s, early 90s. And it was a long, long sketching period or a time during that master plan development or the urban planning development. It took about 10 years. And it's a neighborhood of about 25,000 people when it's completed in 2012. And I've taken this to compare and to just show inspire you a bit to see opportunities for yourself, I think. And it's good we have a client here, actually, again. It's the differences, mainly, it's about the key things. I'm referring back to what I said earlier. It's about ownership, in a way. Who's owning what? And what are we producing buildings and housing or urban structures for? Who are our, you know, customers. And in Stockholm, for example, the state or the city owns quite a lot of the ground. So the same for that competition I showed you earlier. The same thing was here. Which means that they have a clear and strong position in the negotiation with builders during the years to follow, or during the detailed planning period. And they control and they govern this period very carefully. Not like here, where developers have the main authority or the main sort of the main power actually in the implementation of a plan, it's completely shifted to being the authority. They own the public or the civic space, which is very nice. It's a sort of remains from the past, our socialistic past, or the third way past, which we had. And that means that they can clearly make a distinction between what is private and what is public. And I'll just show you a sequence of images that describes that quite carefully. And you can see also that it's a very different culture, unfortunately, or fortunately. And it's about security, for example, that it is still a bit more open, society in the Scandinavian countries. You can just follow me over the bridge here, one of the canals. It's a clear edge, clear urban edge. It is a high quality pavement. It's a defined public and private space. It is designated functions for other things, for things that create the open-minded community, like the black box, which is a bo lokal, which is in English something which is a mixture of living and working, mainly working, or a little office or a cafe or whatever, and you will see how it turns out later here. There's some kind of courtyards, they are open, fully accessible, very restricted private spaces, very carefully designed, very carefully defined, and you can walk through everywhere. It's a diffuse, maybe is a good word. It's not a these sort of semi-private spaces are not that clear. It's some kind of ambiguity within these spaces, but it's thought through. You can sense it. And there are private gardens, of course, and it's not no cameras, no fences. They are exposed immediately to this major public urban space, and they are respected, which is a big difference. And referring back to the introduction here, it's one of our issues, our common issues to deal with in the future, clearly. And there are, it goes on like this. You can't see really that these boundaries that are not clearly defined semi-private or public or private. It's a bit of a mixture, and you can always access through, you can pass through, you can get, you see these this ambiguous spaces between buildings that are actually very popular and people walk and live there. Yes, what do we do then? Do we adhere to these things? Are we behaving? We have, as Ricky said here, we this Greenwich Millennium Village competition in 1997 was of course a very big thing for us. It was a huge international competition. I think you got about 600 entries. At the long list, and it became a short list, and then finally a competition between four. And we were slightly different, I think, in our approach to the problems. And we were quite clear about the urban realm aspect, or the open-minded thing, the open-minded structure. This was the Richard Rogers plan that was sort of the brief during the competition, and it stretched at that time straight up to the dome. The competition area was just a tiny part of it, as you can see in red. And it was a reduced density at that time. The whole density aspect from which you suffer from right now was not on the agenda at that time. So it was maybe 1,000 units within this area, and another 2,500 further up towards the dome. We are now looking at, together with the upper part here, which we are not involved in, but part of, one could say, we are neighbors, about 12 to 14,000 units all over. And it's a dramatic change, of course. This was the earlier typical Ralph Erskine sketch during the competition time. Carefully thought through. Maybe. This is what we are dealing with today. It's about 3,000 units proposed now. The red has been constructed and completed, more or less. The blue and the green represent planning applications being handed in right now. And the orange is phases 3 and 4, where outline planning applications are going in tomorrow, according to the latest news. And so all in all, 3,000 units. And it's a very mixed society, mixed... What do we call it? Is it an urban structure? I don't know. It contains 20% affordable housing in the built areas, including the blue and the green. Another probably 30-35% affordable units in the orange area, reflecting the latest demands from authorities. And it's keeping to its targets, or it's keeping up with it, with the targets, which were very carefully pronounced during the competition or in the submission document at that time. The reduction in waste, the reduction in water consumption, the embodied energy, and all these things are carefully monitored during and have been during 7 years of work. We have been involved. We thought it should have been ready by now, of course, but it is not. And I think that's how things are in this business. It takes time, and it has changed many, many times. And the clients, they have changed, and new people around. And I think I'm the only one left from the beginning of time, which in a team with hundreds of people, it's quite remarkable. And it's interesting, of course, because... if one compares then to the Swedish system, where you spend maybe 10 years in working out these detailed plans for the clients and then hand out, there's clear commission to produce a certain number of units, a certain number of affordable, which is not affordable in Sweden. It's rented accommodation or private accommodation or bought accommodation. This is what you see here has been a process that is maybe much more creative in a way, that is not fixed long time ago, and one has to stick to it. It's changing, but it has got, of course, its downsides, and it's a painful thing for the clients and for people involved that everything is fluent all the time. And this is what it looks like in context. Just a few images and diagrams showing, bits what urban planners are doing or master planners are doing. You can see the structure of the MDL scheme, just above or further up towards the dome, with these maybe 10,000 units up there. These are the completed buildings in phase one, a typical courtyard scenery and an edge scenery, something facing the ecological park in the center of the scheme. It's sort of breeding the same thing, hopefully, as the whole planning procedure or the urban structure does. It's trying to break up scale. It's trying to deal with the problems of density. It's high and low combined, trying to create tolerance for the people living there, creating a tolerance that you can. I mean, if everything was the same, if everything was 12-story high, it is, of course, a disastrous environment. You can say one tries to fake a bit by juxtaposing or the juxtaposition of large and small. And people have started to move in, of course, and it's reflected in their behavior. And according to, I had a little chat here just before with two people, and about and they have interviewed the residents quite a lot for a fairly long time, I think, and got their views. And it is an attempt to try to it has been an attempt and to try to create that kind of identity that you can refer to, you can start to like, and it's not anonymous. The windows are placed a bit every here and there. It's, you know where you live. Your balcony is blue, or mine is green, etc. And it's reflected in the children's conception of it. Just an image showing what it is in context. And the MDL scheme would above this John Harrison Way, which was once the boulevard, Matlock Boulevard, here. It is much denser, much higher, and God knows how they will solve the daylight and the open-minded society. During the process, we have done a large number of design codes, trying to define what things are and why they are, and trying things that were supposed to assist other architects or other consultants, infrastructure, whatever, their way of trying to bring them into one line of action and working in the same direction. We have done a couple of these codes, and it's a quite useful tool in this very long process, and it keeps some kind of continuity and opens up. It's not me. Promise. Have I done something? No. Oh, it's my pacemaker.
It might be a phone if somebody
has it. Yeah, it was probably a phone. In these large projects, of course, it's very important to have documents that protect an original idea to some extent. It has to be open. It has to be an open type of document that could change over time, and it has very dramatically done so. But it is kept to the main principles, and you know, from time to time, we have re-described volumes, reasons, motifs. Etc. And it looked then once upon a time like this. And again, you know, referring back to how do you know, these words in the beginning about what is open-minded, and it is, of course, how you perceive spaces. You don't have, compared to the Swedish scheme where everything is open, you secure, you rely on people, they don't. We don't even have the word social. What is it? Social misbehavior or antisocial behavior? It doesn't really exist. We are not angels. We have got two of our prime ministers killed. It's not that, but it is. These environments work differently, and we don't protect ourselves. But how can we? What are the means? What are our tools to get this kind of see-throughness or transparency into to create depth in these environments, and of course open up the courtyards a bit. We have kept to the idea of courtyards throughout the scheme, which is maybe doubtful actually, but God knows what's happening in the next 10 years if we are still around. But this is just an example how a sort of a public space relates to the semi-private, through stairs, through openings, etc., to create that kind of that type of interest, to break down the scale, to introduce a more human scale in a large, dense, or in a very dense area. And as you can see, then these large volumes are stepping up behind and the combination of low and high, all these things too, in order to try to achieve a slightly better environment. Of course, this is a fortunate scheme. It's a state-owned, English partnership-owned land. They've done enormous investments in cleaning the soil and creating beautiful environments for the new residents, including the birds and the frogs. There's another architectural firm involved in phase two of the project, Proctor Matthews, and they have done approximately the same amount of or number of units as we have done in phase one, together with Hurley Robertson and EPR. This is just the latest sketching for phases three and four. The next coming 1,800 units, and we will probably break the tradition of not doing so much anymore in detailed design, which is probably very healthy if you compare it to the Swedish model there, where different architects dealt with different buildings or different courtyards. This is probably the way forward for the scheme as well. For various reasons, it has not been done like that up to now. This is this process down in Greenwich does deal with the same thing: participation, residents, meetings frequently, and workshops even. A huge workshop took place last December where fundamental things were changed in the scheme, and very useful, of course, and I think a very strong community has been created and a lot of participation, not only in workshops like this, but mentally and spiritually, a very large proportion of committed people to work to the environment they live in. And this is just quick model shots from the completion of phase one, close to the village square, which once was an oval, as you saw in the beginning of these couple of images. Clearly, this is just one tiny part of what you are facing here in this country and in, on this very spot. And I think one has to be... no one can admire you for the scale you are dealing with, because it will put heavy demand on the society that to increase the housing stock and deal with the issues you have, like the affordable. And just interesting, I remember, you know, coming to another country, sometimes you think everything is very confusing. Why are they like they are? We are much better. That kind of behavior, because you don't understand, and it takes time to get into a new culture, really. But I still have some sort of fundamental problem with this affordable housing issue. We have had in Sweden or Scandinavia another approach to it, being rented accommodation. And this Hammarby Sjöstad, this Stockholm Millennium Village, they have probably 30%, they had 50% at one time, but 30% rented accommodation. And then clients or developers that want to go that route, produce rented accommodation, they are immediately, they get subsidies, they get the land for free, there are limits, there are regulations then imposed by the state that there's just a certain amount of rent to be pulled out of the residents. So all sorts of regulations, but these are of course very popular. They don't create you as a human being in the way that affordable housing do here. You are not sort of, you haven't got a stamp in your face that you are live in an affordable accommodation, which I feel you have very much. So you are not allowed to have more than a certain income. And then what happens in your society, or in here in England, when you all of a sudden get that slightly more annual pay and you're not entitled to live in that accommodation anymore. And you can't, but you don't earn much enough to be able to buy one, etc. And in a way, I think your system does prevent a healthy development in a way, or it stops you are associated with your house. But that's very strong, very very sort of fundamental part of you, I think, of the English, that your living is your expression. You express your wealth, your belonging in a way, your everything through your house, your car. We do as well, of course, but I think we don't have those very specific and restricting elements in our housing stock that puts you immediately into one specific file, you may say so. I'll try to conclude. I don't know, I've lost time a bit. I don't know if I've been 5 minutes or half an hour or whatever. I'll just try to I'll do something very dangerous. The postmodern era. This is conclusion, so just hang on, you will survive. You remember the postmodern thinking. It was the 80s mainly, born in the 70s. And what was it? It was expressed in architecture as something when we look upon it today, it's a bit embarrassing, I suppose. It's not very politically correct. Sorry. But the thinking behind was quite fantastic in a way. It was a wedge straight into philosophy, literature, everything, architecture, and an attack on the modern movement, and an attack on the constraints that the modern movement imposed on everything. So what was that constraint then? It was questioning. Someone is ringing again. I'll try to concentrate, and you may do as well. It was questioning the conformity of the society and everything that was protecting the society, one could say, and the adherence to right or wrong. So what was right and wrong, or wrong? It came through, according to the postmodern thinking, the generalization. Generalization was, in the postmodern, or is in the postmodern thinking, something very evil. And it stopped people, or institutions, or everyone, to break new ground, clearly. And it restricted people to the modern movement, or the criticism was that people were restricted to have a free dialogue, or because of the generalization. It is a bit complicated, but I'm not a philosopher. In that breaking of new ground, I think that what the postmodern movement did, it tried to open up the tight grip on the control, or were trying to bring the understanding of chaos into the society, and I think this is where the whole thinking about generalization could be very useful, a very useful tool in urban planning, actually. That it is not a question about right or wrong. It is dealing with urban planning is chaos, really. Clients know, and everyone knows. It is dealing with chaos and trying to bring to have an open-hearted and open-minded attitude to all the issues that urban planning is bringing onto the table or to the table. And since urban planning is a teamwork on a sort of a macro level, it demands very, very open-minded actors and people involved in it. And I just sort of felt the other day that, you know, the thinking of the postmodern maybe is very adequate today. You know, trying to live with cows and trying to not generalize these two things, these two words, not generalizing society, being very conservative. You are conservative when you generalize because you are not an open-hearted person or an individual. Your contribution is conservative. You are a conservative human being. And yeah, cows, if that is next to God, whatever his name is. Thank you.
Johannes, thank you very much. And there are a number of issues to, I think, reflect on. A number of questions, I think, to pursue about. Yes, I was trying to understand what word you were using, and it is chaos. Yes.
Chaos. Oh,
right. Okay.
Sorry.
Because whether it's cows or moo, but I was just reflecting, and I hope we now open up the discussion to other people in the room. But if you take the notion of chaos, the notion of structured disorder. And how you work within that in a sort of open-minded way, taking a number of the key themes you've been talking about today. That's exactly our problem in London, in this vast landscape, which is, on the whole, disordered, which is very, very chaotic. And it just intrigues me to know whether you were being quite kind about the way we're sort of doing things in London. I mean, the implication is that dealing with planning of such a macro scale with this sort of quite piecemeal approach, of which the Greenwich Peninsula is one rather large, but piecemeal, which to a degree doesn't relate to anything that's happening on the other side of the river. There's that extraordinary photograph of the Greenwich Millennium Village with Canary Wharf with the lights shimmering in the background. I mean, those are different worlds if we've ever seen one, and that photograph really shows how London is sort of made up in that way. On the other hand, I remember I was on the jury when Johannes and Ralph won the competition for the Greenwich Millennium Village. On the other hand, what I remember, the reason you guys won that competition is because you were the only ones to have done a sketch which showed the peninsula with not just the site with a red line around it, but actually what might happen to the north, which is more or less what's happened now, what might happen to the south, which no one is thinking about at the moment, and then a big red arrow saying, how the hell do you get from where we are going to be to the center of Greenwich? And just that level of sort of thinking of connectivity and continuity, I think is important. So what is the question? The question is this sort of chaotic approach, which is provocative and interesting, the answer to sort of postmodern or post-industrial planning? And is this a lesson that you've taken away from the UK or from London in particular, and that perhaps some of the models that have been applied in Scandinavia are too prescriptive? I mean, in other words, nearly the opposite. Is that? I'd be interested to hear your view on that. But because you need a drink and a pause, perhaps we can take a number of questions and come back to that in a moment. As ever, if you can ask for the microphone, it'd be great if you tell us who you are and keep your questions, unlike mine, very short, please. If there are some questions.
I'm not sure whether this is a... It's on.
It's on, yes, just okay. Keep it close.
It's a statement or a question, really. I was very curious about what you said about generalizations, because I think underlying every chaotic situation is a generalization.
Cities are generalizations.
I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe. This was hard to express. I'm sorry. I lost my brain a bit when I tried to say it. I think it's a question of attitude, in a way. Maybe, I mean, there are always generalizations because we have a past as human beings. Of course, we have learned everything in a way. We carry a vast bag on our backs, of course. So that is, of course, the conservative aspect or part of us as human beings. So yeah, but the preparedness of being not politically correct, and I think it's funny, Ralph said it, you know, a couple of maybe years ago, and when he summarized his career, and he said, I've always been disliked. I've never been politically correct. And I think maybe that is what I was trying to express, you know, be open-minded enough and dare to, you know, to be embarrassing, as an embarrassing person, because of the courage to say things or do things differently. I don't know, but maybe I think you're right to a large extent.
Another question?
I have to confess one thing. I was lying in the beginning. It was not me on steering the ship. Sorry. That picture was from the early 60s, and I wasn't born then.
This is much more
closer.
Sorry, this is much more, I suppose, a little more pragmatic a question, but it has to do with your reference to the fact that perhaps Sweden is a more open society. And it is something that we grapple with here constantly, is the issues of safety and security, and that there needs to be, there often seems to be a pressure to have very clear lines of demarcation between public and private space. Sorry about that. Just questioning the issues of the cultural issues around demarcations of public and private space. And I guess what I wonder, and I say this not having been to Sweden for, you know, 20 years, but how much do you think it has to do with the scale of a development, and how much does it have to do with cultural diversity? Because I would guess that some of the images, the very lovely images you showed us with the development that had the black studio or cafe, and even then in Greenwich, one feels like they're probably, first of all, isn't close proximity to the kind of hustle and bustle of a metropolis. And it also, I would guess that there might not be that much diversity in those places in terms of the demographics. But I might be wrong, but I'm just curious how much you think those issues might have to do with the public-private split or demarcation.
Yeah, I'll try to be quite frank. And, you know, forgive a foreigner, I'm looking through the room here at someone. I think it is actually a very dramatic difference, unfortunately. I think it's a question of maybe education. I don't know. And this is very not very kind of me saying, but no, let's be frank. I just talked just before, half an hour before the lecture, I talked to people working on sitting here, investigating Greenwich a bit, and they have discovered that in the low-rise courtyards, small courtyards, let's say 25-30 units around a courtyard, people living around that don't want to have children playing in the courtyards because they scream, they behave bad, children behave bad. And maybe you'd like to no. So you just get my interpretation of it, but it's a very shocking thing to hear that they will not permit children playing in the courtyard. So what is the courtyard there for? Then other investigations show that it's nice to look at. So it's good for courtyards without children, because then it's a little tiny private park, protected, not visible. And I think that is that's shocking to hear. And why is it a problem? And I think you have that word again. You have the antisocial behavior word in your language, and there is it is a cultural thing. I can't dream of that same kind of comment or massive, according to what I understood here half an hour ago, criticism to children. I can't imagine that in the Swedish context. What does Lisa say here?
A question there.
A Swede.
And then over here. Maybe we have two together. One and two. Peter?
Johannes, my name is Michael Aulis. We've spoken before. And as you know, I have a Swedish family, but I'm an English architect. Can you hear?
Yes.
Yeah. And the one thing that I've noticed, it shows in that picture actually, but no one's mentioned, is that we all talk in urban planning about people, but no one talks about the person. And the issue of courtyards and large-scale design and small-scale design in Britain is that we forget respect for human beings. And in Sweden, my child plays in the courtyard. In Britain, I'll never let her play in the courtyard. Apart from the neighbours complaining, it's not safe. And there's no respect for human beings. There is a fundamental difference between the human beings in Sweden and in other parts of Europe to here, as well as health and safety issues and legislation that we have here. But there's been no talk of the human being, although I know it figures hugely in the design. Do you want to expand at all? Would you like to expand on the issues of the human being in the way it's designed in a big scale? The individual.
Where have you been in the last hour?
It was too big, in a way, to answer. No, I think that last question was actually very... Or that this is about a courtyard. I think... it is the human being issue, isn't it? You know, how does people participate in our environments? And we have no problem compared, as I said, you know, boring guy saying it again, but, you know.
But I mean, surely what is interesting about the point you've just made, and it's slightly worrying to hear what you said, that you would never let one of your children play in a courtyard, is, you know, what comes first? Is it sort of the mindset, the social mindset of a particular moment in time in British culture which leads to you saying what you have said, and therefore should one not design environments which actually create the potential for that rediscovery of sort of communal life and engagement which somehow happens rather nicely in Notting Hill, say, not that I'm promoting that everyone needs to live in that way or have that level of income. But I think it's worrying to... point the finger at the urban environment or the sequence of public spaces that are made, because they don't particularly suit a particular moment in time of sort of cultural development. And I think was behind, I think, Catherine's question about, do your projects sort of work better if it's all white in one class or makes them diverse? And I think that's the test which some of the researchers are beginning to carry out here in some of these new projects. And I don't think we particularly know the answers, but I don't think one should, in one way, shoot the messenger. The physical environment is the carrier of that potential engagement. If you get rid of the public space, you get rid of everything. Peter.
Hello, my name is Peter Ahrens, and I'm an architect. And I have so many things to talk to you about, and perhaps we'll do that at some other time, but I have one very simple question, which is, how do you see your work relating to the generalized view that I think we all might have of a village? I mean, I ask that because the project is known, and perhaps it's not your title, but the project is known as a Millennium Village or Greenwich Village or whatever, and I'm wondering how you see a relationship between that term,
so that
that term, that name, and your work. Is there a connection for you or not at all?
It was a difficult question. I'm not sure I fully got the essence of it. Just make it a bit simpler.
I mean, the implication behind what you're saying, Peter, is a village is actually quite self-contained, quite small, quite cut off from its surroundings.
Yeah.
And here we are in the middle of a big city. Is it a neighborhood?
Yeah, good.
Village is a generalized view. We have of a 100,000 settlements in a rural condition. And we now have come to accept that things are called villages of the type that you're making, which is no criticism of what you're making. We've come to use that term as though it is synonymous with the other village that we know.
Well, exactly. No, it's very strange. It is not a village, clearly. It maybe was a village, parts of it, in the beginning, but it's never... It turned out to be something very... It's much more urban, of course, as a structure. Yeah, definitely.
Therefore, if I may just go on, and therefore, in relation to the point you make about open-mindedness, I don't quite understand, like the romantic image of the village, which comes from a whole different structure of society, no longer bears reference or relation to the kinds of settlements that we're engaged in making now.
Exactly. I mean, it's a huge contradiction. You know, whatever one says here, or whatever I've said, it is not that simple, of course. It has the other side of the society. That's what I said to my sort of protection. That we can't create open-minded societies everywhere, or streets, or structures. It's not the case. We don't live in that type of scale anymore, of course. But again, it's if you don't carry that as your main sort of that those words or that attitude is your client in a way, then one is lost, because you maybe just get a bit, well, you get a tiny bit of it in the end, and we actually I'll just compare what we are doing. A huge scheme in immediately outside Prague at the moment, a new town completely, which is scaring and worrying in many respects. It's 25,000 inhabitants probably in the near future, or 15 years. And it's, of course, devastating. How do you go about? How romantic can you be? How are you, you know, what's the size of a police station or library or whatever, you know, or mayor's house? You start to, and where does, how soon do you get to a Disney World? And I think that's how, I mean, again, maybe generalization is also trying to, not generalizing is maybe a way ahead even there, because you've got your ideas of the good society, and it is a fake society if you create something from scratch of that scale with the functions of today. The functions in the romantic world were very different. So, I mean, clearly, it's not an unconscious behavior when one deals with these projects, but in a way there has to be a contradiction or a gap between one's ideals and the final expression. Doesn't need to be so bad to have that contradiction. It's painful, but, you know, that's life.
I'm going to bring the talk in the evening to an end now, and thank all of you for your comments. I think what is interesting, simply just by hearing the way you talk and by hearing the way you talk about your subject, and I think the two are connected, there's a sort of both a modesty and uncertainty at times, which rarely happens in the profession, particularly as we practice it in this country. It's either hidden behind a corporate facade, it's either hidden behind enormous security about the ideologies that we're all presenting. But I mean, I think the question Peter Ahrens asks is really a question which is profoundly political, insofar as the concept of an urban village was invented by you-know-who, which I can't mention, because Peter Ahrens gets very upset if I mention the Prince of Wales. the notion of an urban village, even Leon Krier rightly says it's like mixing oil and water. These are two complete opposites. But it's very much the basis of New Labour thinking about what should be happening in the Thames Gateway and these other things called sustainable communities, whatever they are, up and down the country. But I think some of the comments that Johannes has made allow us to reflect that, you know, it is very complex. As you say, there's a lot of pain sometimes involved in resolving these issues. And for that, and for your thoughts and exposure of the work that you've been doing for the last 20 years, and for sharing with us your perspectives on what we're doing here, again, on behalf of the Royal Academy, on behalf of the LSE, thanks very much. Thank you.